don't quite have a quorum yet, but we'll get started here. And welcome to the committee, Representative Zhang. House File 430. And if you want to proceed with your introduction, and then we can proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the past 2 years, the Veterans Defense Project has been conducting outreach and education to public and criminal justice stakeholders to better understand and serve psychologically injured veterans in the criminal justice system. They have made a great deal of progress towards that goal, but their mission is not complete. This appropriation would allow them to complete that mission, and I have Mr. Brock Hunter here who will explain what the resources will be used for and other testifiers here in support of House File 430.
And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and then proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the amendments to the bill too.
We can't do that till.
Oh yeah.
Till I get a quorum. I need one more person, but we'll do the testimony here, so you can proceed, Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Brock Hunter, and I'm an attorney and a veteran, and I've spent the past 20 years working with psychologically injured veterans in the criminal courts, both in Minnesota and across the country. For the past decade, I've also advocated for reforms in the way the justice system as a whole deals with veterans, first here in Minnesota, helping to draft and pass our original pioneering veteran sentencing legislation in 2008, and helping to start our first veterans courts, the first of which was in 2010. And then on a national level, co-founding with Ryan Else, the Veterans Defense Project, a public policy advocacy and education organization. We have helped other states pass legislation and helped establish veterans courts across the country, as well as having been called on to help brief policymakers from the White House to the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs, helping all of them to understand how we can ensure that no veteran is left behind in the criminal justice system. In 2016, we became increasingly concerned about two converging crises back home here in Minnesota. The first of which was the growing wave of veterans that we've seen flooding into the Minnesota criminal justice system in the last few years. After 17 years of continuous war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, the longest wars in our country's history, our military is under unprecedented strain. 2 and 3 combat tours are now commonplace among this generation of veterans, and 4, 5, and 6 tours are not unusual. Some have served many more. Marko Milosevic, who's here present today in the audience and who has testified before other committees in the legislature, served 12 combat tours with the Army's 75th Ranger Regiment. And he has testified that he still has friends serving in special operations who are now over 20 combat deployments. Unprecedented territory for our country. Government studies confirm that the unprecedented length of these wars and the repeated deployments translate directly into higher rates of post-traumatic stress and criminal justice involvement as undiagnosed and untreated veterans self-medicate with alcohol or drugs and fall into self-destructive, reckless, and unfortunately sometimes violent behavior against the very communities that they serve to protect. The second converging crisis that we observed was the growing dysfunction among Minnesota's existing veterans courts. We are no doubt doing some good things for veterans in Minnesota, but our 12 veterans courts serve only a fraction of our 87 counties, and they use a wide variety of different models, some of them much less effective than others. Some of our veterans courts have even been shrinking and in danger of shutting down at a time when the number of veterans flooding into our system is growing. This crisis culminated when the state public defender pulled all of his defenders out of Minnesota's veterans courts in 2017 over concerns for this dysfunction and the disparate treatment veterans have been receiving. Thankfully, that same year, the Minnesota legislature took a major step towards addressing these issues when you provided a grant to the Veterans Defense Project to help our courts improve and expand the way that we deal with our troubled combat veterans. Over the past year and a half, we have been working on several fronts to accomplish what we have come to call our Minnesota mission. The first front of that mission has been the creation of a Veterans Court working group that led to groundbreaking legislation. Upon receipt of the grant, we immediately reached out to key stakeholders across Minnesota's courts and created a working group that included Veterans Court judges, county attorneys, the state public defender, the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Federal Veterans Administration. We have been in intense collaboration for the last 18 months evaluating what is working and not working in Minnesota's veterans courts and looking beyond our borders at what is working best in other states. Next, we collaborated with the prosecutors and the defense lawyers on the working group to draft a groundbreaking piece of legislation, the Minnesota Veterans Restorative Justice Act, which is moving separately through the House and Senate as House File 998. This cutting-edge bill represents unprecedented collaboration among stakeholders and has already gained national attention and promises to serve as a model for the next generation of veterans justice legislation all across the country. The next front in our Minnesota mission was direct outreach to stakeholders through legal education. We have held 20 legal education seminars statewide in the past 18 months, reaching approximately 1,000 stakeholders, including judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, court staff, probation, and law enforcement. The third front has been ongoing publication of written materials, including law review articles, a policy paper, and even short educational brochures for the public. And finally, public outreach and education. We have decided that it's incredibly important, in addition to educating the criminal justice system, to educate the public on these issues because of the stigma the public and veterans themselves often attach to combat trauma, particularly when it leads to criminal behavior. This outreach has included social media. We have reached over 54,000 people through our social media campaign, as well as a series of videos, which have received, as of this week, 9,000 views on Facebook alone. We have one of those videos queued up to play to give you a sense of the kind of stuff that we're doing on that front.
While we get that set up, I'm going to officially, we now have a quorum, call the meeting to order, and I'll move that House File 430 be re-referred to Ways and Means, so it's officially before us, and we'll do the amendment after the presentations.
I thought that joining the military would be kind of like how it is in the movies.
Saving Private Ryan, Black Hawk Down, love those movies growing up. I don't know, it just fascinated me, the uniforms, the camaraderie, the brotherhood.
Be all you can be was the motto when I got in. I wanted a sense of adventure.
My recruiter was a 82nd Airborne paratrooper, and as soon as I talked to him and his stories and how challenging it was, this is something I can do.
The public today, they have no frame of reference for what it means to be a veteran.
We're in our 17th year of war, and we're doing it without a draft this time around. And so we are fighting these longest wars by redeploying the same volunteers over and over and over again in a way we've never done. We have a whole nother level of fanaticism. The suicide bombing tactics create a huge uncertainty for those in the war zone, and that level of hyper-awareness significantly increases psychological injuries.
They brought a 4-year-old little girl to me. She had one arm and half a face. The things like that are the things that can't be unseen.
Just like I got used to the training, I got used to seeing horrific things, I got used to bottling up, and I got used to squashing it down.
Multiple people told me I had PTSD while I was in the Marine Corps and told me I needed to seek help. I refused to. Having issues like that while you're in the service is frowned upon.
They train you to go to Iraq. They don't train you to come back.
The transition back to civilian life can be immensely difficult.
I felt like I was set up to fail.
Those experiences that I had will never go away. The thoughts and the loss will never go away.
I didn't want to wake up. I hated who I was.
I lost my temper a lot. I'd get angry, and I would be able to vent my frustrations physically. And that's what I did when I was in Iraq, and that's what I did when I got home, and it was wrong, and it didn't work out for me.
I got into using drugs so that I didn't have to sleep because I didn't want to have to deal with nightmares. I didn't think about the law. I didn't think about the consequences, but they surely started to come.
In a regular criminal court, the model is meant to be adversarial. There is no positive reinforcement. There's only, you're doing something wrong, we're going to punish you for that.
putting a traumatized veteran in a cage does not solve their problems. They come out of the cage worse off, posing a greater threat to the public than they did before.
After I got out of jail, I went back to using it and I got angry, even more so than I was before.
And it's not long before they are back in trouble again and back in the court. Veterans courts are intended to break that cycle of recidivism by setting aside the specific conduct that got the veteran in trouble and focusing instead on the underlying mental health and substance abuse issues that drove that conduct.
The right thing to do with these people is get at what drove them to get to me in the first place.
It's totally different. It's like taking the paradigm and shaking it all up and then putting it back together again and thinking about it from a different way. It's a team perspective, and everybody is there for the participant's success.
There's an element of trust in everything, from treatment to the court to treatment to probation to the veteran, that we all have to build through this court process to be successful.
Veterans Court isn't a get out of jail free card, but what it is an opportunity to do a positive intervention and get good people on the right track in life.
Many of the vets that come through this court will say, "The last time that I felt this much hope and this much potential is when I was serving this country, and I had a team of people around me that I could rely on that were consistent, that held me to my highest level of potential."
We've known about PTSD, we've known about the effects of war, and we've continued to send people to war. That decision comes with the weight that we have to help the people that come back.
And I'm not about to start making guys convicted felons until I've given a shot at getting them squared away again. I think we owe it to them.
We're going to have thousands and thousands and thousands more veterans coming back who have seen more combat over a longer period of time. This is only going to escalate. And the faster we can get on to the Veterans Court movement, the better off our returning soldiers are going to be, and the safer we're all going to be.
Mr. Chair, the current grant request would simply allow the Veterans Defense Project to continue working with Minnesota stakeholders to complete our Minnesota mission. Though we have reached 1,000 of our stakeholders through direct CLEs, there are thousands more who have not yet been trained. And if the Veterans Restorative Justice Act passes, which we hope and believe it will, we believe that a comprehensive statewide training will be necessary to ensure that it is properly understood and implemented by our stakeholders. This act represents a very significant change in the normal course of criminal court business. In order to achieve the actual intended result of this act, we believe that all stakeholders need to have pretty intensive training, not just by VDP staff, but by the members of our working group, the judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys who we've been working with for the last 18 months would travel with us across the state, training all of the judicial districts to make sure they understand this. We would also continue our public education and outreach efforts with videos and other materials such as the one that you've just seen. Together we can and we must ensure that no veteran is left behind in the criminal justice system.
Thank you. I also have John Choi that wants to speak. We'll do the questions at the end. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Choi. I am the service of Ramsey County Attorney, and today I'm really happy to be here today to support this bill. I also want to thank Representative Zhang for his leadership. As the county attorney, in 2013 in Ramsey County, we started our Veterans Court, and I thought that at that time we did everything that we needed to do for veterans, because getting a Veterans Court started was a huge task. But as a part of the education this organization undertook just within our own jurisdiction, what we came to realize is that there were so many more things that we could be doing better. And just the education that was provided not only to the prosecutors in Ramsey County, at the city, at the county level,
but also our system players, the judges who have participated in our Veterans Court. We've benefited very greatly from this process to also engage in looking at some of the things that are happening in our Veterans Court and how we could actually improve it, and recognizing the additional people that would be coming through our Veterans Court. But the reality is that some of our numbers were going down in Veterans Court, and I think one of the things is that one of the big challenges is identifying veterans that are in our system, and that's one of the things that the takeaway that I took from some of the education outreach is that there's a lot more veterans that are in our systems, but we're not doing the things that we need to do to properly identify those individuals. And in addition to that, I really appreciate the efforts that were undertaken outside of Ramsey County where they don't have a Veterans Court. I have a lot of colleagues now, elected colleagues throughout the state of Minnesota, that have a much, much greater interest in wanting to start or undertake some initiatives to do something in their communities throughout Minnesota, and they've got the resources and the support to do that through this appropriation. So I just encourage you, Mr. Chairman, and members of this committee to support this appropriation bill, because the work that the organization is doing to educate the system players and the public is really, really critical. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Next I have Tommy Johnson. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Tommy Johnson. I'm the legislative officer for the Veterans of Foreign Wars Department of Minnesota. I'm also involved with the Commander's Task Force, which is made up of all nine congressionally chartered veteran service organizations, from the American Legion to the Marine Corps League to the Disabled American Veterans to the Jewish War Veterans to the Veterans of Foreign Wars. We support this bill entirely. In the military, they talk about plans are good, logistics are better. Having a veterans court is very important. It changes lives not only in the veterans but in the spouses and in the kids. It allows children to be able to say my mommy is a hero instead of my mommy is a felon, or my daddy is a hero instead of my daddy is a felon, and it changes lives of families. Planning is good, but logistics are better. This bill is going to allow the Veterans Defense Project to get out and to actually work with the courts to let them see how this works. And I can't stress enough how important this is and the support of the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the members of the Commander's Task Force. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Any other testifiers that want to speak for this bill or to this bill? If not, Representative Zhang, I understand we have an amendment here. If you want to explain what the amendment changes or does. And
Mr. Chair, members, my understanding is that the amendment would change the funding from the Humanities Center to the Commissioner of Veteran Affairs, and just some small language changes in the report.
Okay. I'll move the House or the DE2 amendment. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm noticing that this deletes out reference to the Veterans Defense Project. What is wrong with the Veterans Defense Project that you are now changing this so that they're deleted out?
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, some concerns had been raised in a previous committee regarding the fact that the Veterans Defense Project received our original grant without any kind of RFP or bidding type of competitive process. We're not aware of any other organization in the state or country that does this kind of work, but we acknowledge that that is in fact the case. And to address those concerns, in addition to making the Department of Veterans Affairs the fiscal agent for any future grant, we also accepted that criticism and are proposing that there would be an RFP and competitive bidding process. So rather than the grant specifically be entitled to go to us, it would be a Veterans Justice grant, and we would submit a proposal to the state to get that grant.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. is the current organization broken? Is the system wrong? I mean, what is the justification if it's not broke? Why fix it? I understand that, well, then it sounds right. But if we found something that works, then why aren't we just continuing it instead of, I mean, so how much cost running the grant program, running the overhead? What if an organization comes in and writes a nice grant, but they're an unknown entity, and they win it? Why don't we just stick with what is apparently working really well and not mess with it?
Mr. Hunter, Representative Zhang?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I don't disagree with you. I don't think that there's anything wrong or broken with the Veterans Defense Project or the approach we've taken. In fact, I'm quite proud of the work we've done under the current grant, and I think we are far better poised to follow through and complete this Minnesota mission than any other group out there. But we are sensitive to concerns that were raised by members of a past committee that this bill passed through that raised this issue, and we just want complete transparency. We have nothing to hide, and we believe we are by far the most qualified organization to continue this mission, and so we readily agreed that we would be happy to compete in that process.
Representative Hewitt, is this on the amendment or?
On the amendment. Mr. Chair, Representative Zhang, will this change anything or hamper them in any way to continue their mission?
Representative Zhang?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe not so, but I will let Hunter add more details.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess we're not entirely sure what this RFP process would look like or how long it would take, I guess, and how quickly it would get initiated. It might delay things a little bit if we have to go through that competitive process in order to get the grant to continue moving forward. Again, I guess that's a balancing act as far as efficiency versus transparency. And I guess I would leave that up to you electeds to decide where that best fits.
Representative Hewitt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zhang, but this is getting it right. This is what we have to do to get the process corrected, correct?
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know. Again, we want to have as much bipartisan support for this process as absolutely possible. We think this is a win-win for the state. We're happy to participate in this process as that's represented in this amendment. So we have no complaint about it.
Mr. Chair, members, this amendment was brought to me forward from Republicans and Democrats who wanted to see changes to this bill to be more transparent. So that's all I'm doing is working with folks from both sides of the aisle to ensure we get this bill passed and that it's representative of everyone's view.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, if it's working now, where would, and it ends up being a grant proposal, where else would the dollars go besides this program? Who else would be able to tap into these funds?
Mr. Hewitt. Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keel. I believe the way that the amendment is written, it would be a state organization that would apply for this grant and continue to move forward with this mission on all of the various fronts that we defined it, the various four approaches that we've been taking to use our existing grant funding. We had a board meeting last night, and there was continued discussion and brainstorming as to what else we could do to more effectively accomplish this mission. So this is a constantly evolving and improving process. But those are the four major approaches that we've identified so far that we think are most effective in the use of the state money to best help justice-involved veterans.
Representative Keel.
Thank you.
Representative Quam.
I just want to say the way you have the amendment is sort of the way it should have started out. But once you get something that's working and fixing and you know, isn't broken, I just hope we don't get what we ask for and have multiple organizations, as it says in the amendment, grants to an organization or organizations, and we end up getting an unknown. Once we know something's working, I have fear of that unknown, but thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I share your concerns, and I hear you on that, but then again, going back to what I mentioned earlier, this was specifically brought to us by your colleague, Representative Detmer, and Republican colleague, Sandy Judiciary Committee.
Representative Kwan.
Sometimes we get what we ask for, and sometimes it's good, and sometimes there are unintended consequences. I understand the intent, but I like how we're progressing, and hope that we don't have this open up an issue.
Representative Carr, I appreciate that. I hope you also have a conversation with your colleagues too.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the amendment, it also changes where the grant funds are appropriated from the Minnesota Humanities Center to the Commission of Veterans Affairs. Correct? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Representative Olson.
So to that point, is that a welcome change by the departments?
Representative Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Just by way of a little history, in our original grant proposal to the legislature 2 years ago, we had the Department of Veterans Affairs as our fiscal agent. During the process of moving through the legislature, Representative Sarah Anderson, who was, I believe, the chair of this committee or at the time, asked that the fiscal agent be changed to the Humanities Center, which we went along with. And our relationship with the Humanities Center has been great. They've been doing well. But there were concerns raised by some members of the legislature wanting to see this fall within the Department of Veterans Affairs. We have no problem with that at all. The Department of Veterans Affairs has been part of our working group all through this 18-month process, and they are supportive of this idea and are prepared to take on that extra role.
Representative Olson.
All right, thank you much. And I won't call up the department. I see some head nodding in as well, so thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Zhang, something to maybe even consider maybe as a grant compromise between instead of issuing the grant versus the RFP, a lot of times departments can do a grant solicitation. So instead of the formal RFP process, they have to prepare this whole package of information and send it out. They can just solicit requests for the grants and then see who applies. A lot of times in municipalities, when they know that there's a smaller group of organizations that are qualified for these things, a grant solicitation can expedite that process quite a bit. So it's still, there's the transparency. Everybody's allowed to submit a request for funding, but it doesn't require that Blue Ribbon Commission to then evaluate all those RFP proposals. So I know you got this. So I'm going to support you in this because you've got a bipartisan amendment here. But know that there are, it doesn't have to be one extreme or the other. There are other options to still shine that light of transparency on these types of proposals.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, as we look at the amendment and the administration of this, and I look at how the money has been spent up to now, it appears most of it has gone for what I would consider to be overhead, payroll. I'm looking at the report that was given. 55% of it is gone for payroll. Close to another 20% has gone for printing and cost and so forth. So I have concerns with how, especially if we're going to change this, how are we really getting at the meat of the problem, which is the money actually going to the people that need it, rather than basically having a department to administer things?
Mr. Hunter, and I believe this is a counseling type program, and that's so there. That I would think that would why you'd be payroll heavy is that it's not money going to people, it's counseling help going to people through people.
Right. Representative Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, that's correct. We're a public policy advocacy and education group, so we are not providing direct services. We are working to change the way the whole justice system views and deals with the veterans coming through it. And so by necessity, a good portion of our budget goes to the payroll of our staff who are out doing this education and advocacy work. That budget you're looking at was our original first year budget. It has evolved since then to include a lot of the stuff like the video productions that you've just watched, which we found to be incredibly effective in public education and outreach. But yes, as an education and advocacy group, that is, and I think, a fairly common budget structure for organizations like ours.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then, how are you tracking the impact of the money that you're spending? In other words, you know, I look at this as a lot of overhead, people, and now facilities and everything that we've created another department. How are you tracking the effectiveness relative to the money that you're spending?
It's a challenge, Mr. Chair, or Representative Vogel, because the courts are not currently tracking the numbers of veterans coming through our criminal courts. A couple of counties, we've seen some numbers of jail admits coming through, showing escalating numbers. Anecdotally, I think it's pretty clear to everybody involved in this process that the number of veterans coming into the justice system is increasing. And the statute, or the Veterans Restorative Justice Act bill that we have introduced is a product of some very intense and groundbreaking collaboration among all of these stakeholders, as you heard from Ramsey County Attorney Choi. Many, many hours spent getting all of the justice system stakeholders on the same page regarding how we're going to do this statewide going forward. It's hard to put numbers to that, but I would say that particularly if this act passes, but even if it doesn't, it's going to have a dramatic impact on every justice-involved veteran coming through the Minnesota system in the short and long term. And it's going to bring the public defenders who had left the veterans courts 2 years ago back into the courts, so the money being spent on the public defenders already will immediately go back into helping the veterans coming through the system. But I agree, putting a dollar value on the value that we brought to this is a challenge because of the amorphous nature of this problem.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question then, I guess, is from the taxpayers' perspective, and they want the veterans to be helped, how are you going to put something in place that gives definitive proof that the money is being spent with an outcome? And I realize what you just said is helpful, but it is, you know, it's a bunch of money. And I'm just curious, how are you putting in those tracking mechanisms to make sure that we're not creating a department that is doing nice things, but not necessarily relative to the funds that are being spent, can objectively say this is what we've accomplished?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, we would love nothing more than to see the courts tracking the number of veterans coming through the system in a very systematic way. And that would be part of our effort, just to get them on board with doing just that. The state public defenders have now started tracking every veteran defendant that they are now working with. And I would expect in the next 2 years, part of our ongoing collaboration would be increasing ways that we can track the metrics of the veterans coming through the system and start tracking the impacts of the changes that we've worked on the system to show some concrete benefit. That knowing these metrics, I think, would be incredibly valuable for the state on many, many levels.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That might be a helpful thing to include in the next report, then, some of that objective stuff. Thank you.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members and testifiers. I'm a mediator, which is very different from being a lawyer, but I have to take continuing legal ed credits. I was shocked to go into a continuing legal ed course at one point, and a judge was teaching it, and it was actually about exploiting the mental health situations in order to gain convictions. And when I asked the judge who was teaching the CLE about this, the mental health accommodation piece, and I said, well, wait a minute, isn't this really unjust to use someone's mental health condition against them. And it was explained to me at that time that if we had to take mental health into consideration, many of our prisons would be empty. It was a shocking statement, but there's a difference between law and justice. The law is the law. And so it was explained to me also that the fiduciary responsibility of the prosecutor was to make sure that the prosecution was taken to its fullest. With that in mind, I would like to see the program that you're talking about expanded so that we are not exploiting people based on the mental trauma and harm that they have received through service to our country. And in thinking about that, my question is, as Representative Vogel talked about, the costs are high. Training is expensive. Is there a plan to expand these CLEs that you are currently providing to make them a little broader so that we reach more prosecutors? Because if one side of the table is being represented, I would certainly like to see the other side of the table represented so that mental health isn't exploited to gain convictions. And so I would like to know how you plan to expand these CLEs to a greater point to reach more people.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is precisely what our plan would be under this grant, is to continue and expand our continuing legal education efforts. As I stated, under the current grant, we have done 20 legal education seminars across the state, reaching approximately 1,000 stakeholders. We have many more thousands to go. And particularly if we're able to pass the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, we think there will be a dramatic need to get out and do intensive training. So what we have envisioned is day-long trainings, multidisciplinary trainings in each of the judicial districts across the state over the next 2 years, reaching all of the judges, all of the prosecutors, all of the private and public defenders, as well as probation, law enforcement, and anyone else in the system who is dealing with veterans. I can't agree with you more. The statements that you're saying you heard at the CLE from this judge are exactly contrary to the way I feel that mental health should be dealt with in the criminal court system, not just among veterans, but anybody suffering from mental health issues. That should not be used against them, but should be taken into consideration as a mitigating factor in how we decide to deal with them. Our mission is dealing with veterans in the system. I think it is an acute issue in the first place to start, given the acute crisis that I don't think it's an overstatement to say is a building public health and public safety concern among this generation of veterans if we don't effectively start addressing them and using a criminal court contact as an intervention opportunity to get them help and get them headed in a better direction. Mm-hmm.
I would just like to add, when we're looking at the cost of this, there have been estimates out there that to incarcerate an individual is upwards of $40,000. And so when we're looking at the cost of an executive director at $52,000 and one prison bed at $40,000 plus, it seems like a wash.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if there's someone in the audience from Veterans Affairs that I could ask a couple questions of.
If you want to make your way down.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the State Department of Veterans Affairs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Perry. Good morning, Mr. Johnson. I'm going to start with this question, and it's not intended to be, as trite, but what is the mission of the Veterans Administration? What is the mission of your department?
To serve all veterans and their families in the state of Minnesota and ensure that they receive the benefits that they've earned.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Johnson, do you also work in the area of advocacy for veterans in the criminal justice system?
Chair, Representative,
Mr. Johnson.
Not directly, no, sir.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, your mandate is to serve veterans wherever they might go as an advocate. That is correct, and you've stated as such. I'm just wondering, if you are acting as an advocate for veterans, how might you look upon an additional $400,000 or so per year to promote advocacy in the criminal justice system for veterans?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Representative, we look upon it as an opportunity to expand the reach into an area that is currently underserved. MDVA has limited capacity to serve veterans in the criminal justice system to the point where something like this would be an effective use of those dollars, and it's something that we would be happy to support.
Mr. Walbright. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I think by your mandate, this is within your wheelhouse, and given the fact that our veterans, I think, have a right to be served in a proper and appropriate manner by state employees, I think that the money would be better directed towards your program than others that seem a bit duplicitous in their advocacy for the same mandate that you have as your charter. So I'll leave it at that.
Seeing no further member questions, let's move to take a vote on the amendment. As I said, I move the DE2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And Representative Long, before we vote on the vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to thank the author, Representative Zhang. I'm happy to be a co-sponsor of this bill. I think that the work the Veterans Defense Project has done has been admirable, and when we are working on what is really shifting a paradigm and doing groundbreaking work and trying to bring veterans courts to the state, I think that that's going to require a lot of education. It's going to require a lot of outreach across the state. We have many veterans courts in the state that have been national models, and I think that to attorney County Attorney Choi's point, it takes a lot of work to set these courts up, to do them right, and to make sure that we're expanding these models across the state. I think our veterans deserve it, and I just wanted to thank you, Representative Zhang, for bringing this bill forward.
Any further member questions, comments? If not, all in favor of House, I'll renew my motion that House File 430 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. You're on your way, and thank you for the presentation. And while we're waiting here, our next bill is 1698, which is also Representative Zhang. And while we're waiting for this to stand down here, I'd just like to tell you that we got an email from Carlos, Representative Mariani, and he's not going to be presenting his bill today, so he's asking it to be pulled from the agenda. Representative Zhang, welcome back. Long
thank
time
you.
No see.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I might as well be a member of this committee, right? I'm here today again to ask for your support for House File 1698, a one-time appropriation of $75,000 to fund Veterans Voices Career Project. AMPRS is the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Station. The association represents 18 independent community radio stations around the state. I have four AMPRS radio stations that serve my district, including KFAI, which has programming in 12 different languages, including Somali, Hmong, Oromo, Spanish, and more. The Veterans Voices Radio Project is an important program that not only gives Minnesota's veterans the opportunity to share their stories, it captures and archives these stories, which are important to our history. I'm joined by AMPRS CEO Joel Glazer, who can share a little bit more about the Veterans Voices Radio Project.
And members, before we get Mr. Glazer up there, I'll move House File 1698 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And I see we have our technology guru up there. Trying to get it up on.
That's a stretch. It was working before. Okay.
additional things.
While we're waiting here, why don't we do the minutes, get them out of the way. Representative Vogel, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I will move the minutes of the last meeting, Mr. Chair.
Representative Vogel moves the minutes of the past meeting. All in favor? Approval of the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. Most of the minutes are approved. Here we go. And Mr. Glazer, if you could introduce yourself for the tape. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I am the CEO of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. I apologize for that brief interruption. They wanted me to use a different computer because of the video, and the second computer decided to act up. I will keep it brief this morning. I want to thank you again for having us here today, and I would like to thank our author, Representative Zhang, for carrying our bill. Again, we are with the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations. Just a very quick, brief reminder that we are not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio, Twin Cities Public Television, or Minnesota Public Television Association. As Representative Zhang mentioned, we are an association that represents 18 community radio stations throughout Minnesota, four of them here in the Twin Cities, and then the remaining 14 in greater Minnesota. We are here today to talk about House File 1698, our Veterans Voices project. Veterans Voices started in 2015 with our Veterans Voices World War II Memories and Stories of Minnesota's World War II Veterans. After that, we moved on to partner with the Humanities Center and recognized their 40 under 40, 40 veterans under the age of 40 of Minnesota and the accomplishments that they had made to our community. We moved on after that to Veterans Voices Native Warriors, and the reason for that is Native Americans actually have the highest per capita of any cultural group serving in the armed forces nationwide. And then 2 years ago, we asked for funding for Vietnam as well as Korea.
I know.
This is Veterans Voices with Kevin Berger, Memories and Stories of Minnesota's Vietnam Veterans.
Dennis Mitchell was drafted and arrived in Vietnam at age 21.
A number of us carried machetes. We would have to clear areas in the jungle as we walked through because we were told not to walk on paths because they could be very dangerous.
From fear of triggering a booby trap to an unexpected ambush, Mitchell saw danger firsthand, including what happened to a buddy.
We were supposed to share the foxhole together. He elected to go to the different foxhole right over, which is usually about 6-8 feet away. He didn't make it.
It's like, what happened?
Well, he got shot. The enemy came through our perimeter.
Looking like walking trees, the camouflage troops cautiously sweep toward a simulated DC position.
As news reports from the time suggest, the war theater was ill-defined, leaving soldiers on the offensive guessing the loyalties of those they encountered off the battlefield.
World War II, you knew who the enemy was. But the Vietnam War, you had an idea who the enemy was, but really didn't. It could have been somebody within the village there that you were just passing through. It's like hit and miss. I mean, you walk in and you got these little kids and so forth. You feel real nice, and next thing you know, you don't know if they're carrying a grenade and they're going to blow you up.
50 years after his service ended, Mitchell still feels fortunate.
I'm very appreciative of that I came home in the one piece that I have.
Veterans Voices Vietnam is produced by AMPRS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with the Minnesota Humanities Center and support from the state of Minnesota. Online at AMPRS.org.
With the funds that we received, we created the 2-minute radio segments that you just heard. We also created 15 to 20-minute podcasts, and that came out of demand because we were hearing from people that they wanted more. They wanted to hear far more from these veterans than we could put in 2 minutes on the radio. But when it comes to radio, 15 or 20 minutes is a very long time period. So we are doing the 2-minute on-air pieces as well as the 15 to 20-minute podcasts that go along with it. We do put the 2-minute segments onto CDs that we give out at the Minnesota State Fair. They are wildly successful. We actually have people come back year after year asking what the next Veterans Voices project is and do we have it ready for them this year. As I have mentioned previously, sometimes they will actually ask for a stack, and the reason for that is because they are teachers. And while we do make it available online to teachers, there are some in Greater Minnesota where that technology is not as readily accessible, so they do prefer the CD, and to date, the CD is still really the best option for distributing. We know going forward there will be better options, but right now it's still the CDs. The neat thing about working with the teachers is we did a teacher research group, a focus group, and they informed us that they not only use the 2 minutes, which they say are great idea starters to get the conversation going with the students, they then also use the 15 to 20-minute podcasts as either homework, or they will ask the students to use part of that to come back and give a presentation. But perhaps most importantly, and the most exciting part of what they talk about, is that the students become much more engaged in what they might feel is an otherwise boring topic when they actually hear firsthand stories from somebody who actually lives in their state about what it was like to serve in Vietnam or serve in World War II. And then finally, I'd like to point out that we do save every single minute that we record, and former Commissioner Shillitoe asked that we turn this over to the Minnesota Historical Society. They have agreed that they do want all of the audio. They have asked for us to hang tight right now because they want to make sure they have an archivist for fear of us giving all the audio and it ending up in a server in the basement somewhere and never be seen again. So we are working with them to make that happen. 2 years ago, we asked for funding for Vietnam and Korea, and I would like to thank this group for funding Vietnam. Unfortunately, we did not get the funding for Korea. And even though Korea happened the year prior, and right now that window is really closing. The Korean vets, unfortunately, are dying off. If we don't do this project now, the war is referred to as the Forgotten War, and unfortunately it would most likely become the Forgotten War for this project as well, and we really do not want that to happen. With House File 1698, we are asking for a one-time appropriation of $75,000. That $75,000 takes care of everything that we were talking about, the two-minute segments, the CDs, the podcast, working with the teachers, all included. I'd like to wrap up, if I can draw your attention to either the handout that I gave you or to the screen, because we do have 3 bills going through this committee, and I want to take just about a minute and a half to kind of explain, because there is a little bit of confusion. So House File 1303, which has our community service and equipment grants. So all of the grants do go through the Department of Administration for us. They are our fiscal agent. That money goes to the Department of Administration, and then they enter into sub-grants for 17 different grants to all 17 of the stations. That money does not flow through AMPRS. We do not take an admin fee. We are not affiliated with that funding. We just help them. We help to represent them here rather than having to have each one of them come individually. House File 354, you may recall when I was in front of this committee, is our opioid prevention and awareness campaign. And that is a partnership. While we are not owned or receive money from, it is a partnership with Twin Cities Public Television. TV is far more expensive to produce than radio. So of that 1.6 for that very important peer-to-peer opioid prevention and awareness campaign, especially in the diverse communities, $1.2 million of that is going to TPT, so there's $400,000 of that that is going to AMPRS. And then here today we are talking about the $75,000 that would flow through the Department of Administration, and that would go to AMPRS to create these segments as well as the podcast and distribute that all out statewide as well. So the AMPRS portion of this is actually $475,000. The rest is all going directly to the stations in your local community. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to thank you for your continued support and ask that you do hopefully support House File 1698, and I am available should you have any questions.
Representative Olson. You had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More just a comment that you've been before this committee a few times and appreciate the reach that you have through using what I would say is pretty limited dollars. You have a pretty far reach across the state of Minnesota. And I think it's really important that veterans issues not just be tackled by the Department of Veterans Affairs, but I think contrary to Representative Albright's point, that I think you do good work and can really amplify the work, and I support this legislation moving forward.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Hewitt?
Just real quickly, as a Gold Star family member and also as a child of World War II veterans who are no longer with us, it's great that you can record these voices, get them into our archives, because it's our children and our grandchildren that are going to listen to these tapes, and I really appreciate that, so I, too, will support this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My late father was a Korean War veteran, and so I feel the urgency of this as well. I mean, if we don't do the Korean vets now, they're not going to be any left by the time that we have another opportunity to do this. So I strongly support this as well.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Albright.
Mr. Glazer, thank you for bringing this forward. My father-in-law is a decorated Korean War veteran. And just as a side note, when Saving Private Ryan came out, I think that was a real tipping point for a number of his brotherhood that allowed them to speak more freely about that. I certainly support your efforts on behalf of my father-in-law wholeheartedly, so thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. Any further questions? Anyone else in the audience that needs to speak to or for this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 1698 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Zhang, and today you're a member of the committee. Again, 1601, we've been asked to pull. Representative Lesh, I saw you come in. House File 804, and I'll move that House File 804 be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee, Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill is the Legislative Commission on Data Practices, which was former Representative Mary Liz Holberg's dream when she brought it in first in 2014 was the first time I heard her speak about it. But we set it up, and the purpose and whole point behind her vision was it was 2007 was the first year that, because of the complicated nature of data practices and all the moving pieces, we imposed a House rule stating that any bill involving data practices, changing data sets, involving personal privacy or government transparency had to be sent to the Civil Law Committee. And that was the year that I chaired the Civil Law Committee, so they all came to me. And so I became the inheritor of her, at least on the DFL side, vision to make sure that we had a legislative commission that was up to speed on examining all the implications of data practices for the personal privacy of your constituents, but also for the full transparency of government operations. And this commission was intended to take on all those issues, distill them down to understandable parcels so that we could effectively vote on them in the greater body of the House of Representatives, as well as in the Senate. And it was partially because any time that some of these issues came up, you'd see people's eyes roll into the back of their heads, kind of like when folks talk about tax policy. Was to make it, to give the responsibilities to a set of legislators who could distill those issues. And so this is the continuing effort. We think it's still a noble effort. We do good work and have done good work in the Legislative Data Practices Commission, and so we're asking that it be extended.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Any questions? Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Lesh, brought this forward before Judiciary and provided some additional background to it. You know, we are the issues keep changing, right? That with the use of technology and how protecting people's privacy in the digital age is ever more important. So I fully do support this, and as they continue their work and bringing that information back to the legislature, I think is still very valuable. So I support this bill.
Representative Plum. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And noticing that the unofficial lobbyist for the twice exceptional isn't here, I just wanted to ask if the author knows if the Data Practices Legislative Commission is involved with cross-media accessibility for the data information.
Representative Lesh.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Quam.
He's speaking, Mr. Heller.
Yeah, I mean, he's my constituent, Mr. Chair, so yes, he's visited me frequently before he got to all you. But yes, I've been working with him on that, and it is one of the issues that he's brought up. He's got a myriad of issues that he wants to be brought forth, but the accessibility portion is something, especially with respect to the PDFs, the type of PDF that he wants is a relatively large nut to crack, but it is, I think, relevant to a transparency issue. So, yes.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and knowing that he was a constituent, I want you to let him know that we did cover him when he wasn't here.
Excellent. I will. Thank you.
Representative,
sure his ears are burning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and knowing myself of Representative Holberg and her fiscal concerns, I'm wondering, it appears as if the office has been just kind of the commission has been helped by basically just part-time use of LCC staff. But now it appears as if we're going to turn it into an operation. And maybe just a comment, why, if it's made it this long and was a good idea, we're going to now spend $250,000 a biennium on creating another office with overhead.
Well,
Representative Lesh.
Ms. Chair and Representative Vogel, I would say that it hasn't, we have limped along in the amount of time up to now. Existing infrastructure has been generous in a temporary sort of donation of their time, but in reality, the staff person who has staffed it, you know what it's like to try to herd cats. You're all a bunch of cats, legislators, try to get your schedules together as to when we can meet. The Senate's even worse. And so we do need the help to make sure that we're doing it. There have been gaps in what we've been able to do and what we've been able to cover because there's just sort of been this, we've been operating on this fiction that the existing administrative infrastructure has been covering, and it hasn't. It's been sort of a wink and a nod. So we're trying to give it the legitimacy that was the originally intended under Representative Holberg.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. So was it a concern of Representative Holberg when at the outset that that's where this would go, that we had actually turned it into an office with staff?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Vogel, I can't speak to you know, what was on her mind. I recall generally what was on her mind from the beginning of what she, in terms of what she spoke of, but she did want the commission to be taken seriously and not, you know, just kind of an afterthought, that we were going to do serious work in that commission. So I can say yes, it was her intent that it be taken as seriously as any other commission that we have in the legislature.
And Chair Lesh, I know Mr. Nobles, when he's down here and he's asked about additional stuff being put on his plate, sometimes he says, you can give me more than tell me to do that stuff, but that means other stuff's not going to get done. I can only do what I have time to do. Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just bring it up because I know there's been discussion on even things like the Legislative Budget Office not being there because it's costing so much, and yet if we're going to look at something which I think is as valuable as that and then starting something new, maybe we have to do a little bit of a balancing act here to make sure that if indeed we're going to start increasing staffing for these other commissions and then use it as justification to get rid of something that really is, I think, a tremendous benefit, that things kind of even out. Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, so a lot of times we talk about data. We talk about data in the context of what we know today, but you know, much like the Pension Commission has legitimacy because they're bringing forward legislation that, you know, affects a number of constituencies. I'm just wondering if the scope of your commission that you're bringing forward today is going to expand just with the prevalence of, you know, cyber, with all of the initiatives from a business perspective about data, about, you know, cyber attack, about cybersecurity. Are those relevant to your commission, and are you looking to expand or, you know, kind of enhance the scope or parameters of what your task is with that commission?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. That's a good question. Just a little bit of background about how this has kind of grown beyond by our own control of it. The Minnesota Data Practices Act, which was enacted in the 70s, along with much of the national personal privacy and government transparency legislation in the wake of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, et cetera, states that any data is by default, as many of you know this in the state of Minnesota, is by default public, unless this legislature creates a data set making it non-public, confidential, private. That of course has been the case since the 70s. What we noticed, a real change in the amount of work that we had to do related to that once new technology started coming online in the digital age that created new data sets that had no classifications, especially in things the government did. So governments began using a lot more heavily large mainframes or web-based databases that were public information that the agencies didn't realize that we hadn't created a data set for them, and all of a sudden governments paying out millions of dollars in civil suits because of breaches or because of unauthorized use of them was one of those things we had to deal with. Then new technologies that came online that were used by government, some especially with respect to law enforcement, like cell phone exploitation devices, license plate readers, body cams, began coming online and being used without any authorization of this legislature. But we ended up having to deal with it because they were creating data sets that were public. The police raided your neighbor's house next door, and without a data set on that body cam, you had access to find out what was going on in your neighbor's house, so you could follow the cop's camera coming in. So the point of the commission was to try to get ahead of this so that we wouldn't be spending inordinate amounts of legislative time that our hand was forced by not our decision to take on these issues, but the technologies and the way that the Data Practices Act is set up. That's what forced our hand. So, yes, I think I don't anticipate what's coming after what's next. I imagine facial recognition technology where you walk into the DMV and it'd be great. You won't have to wait in line because it'll recognize your face and it'll say, Mike Nelson, report to counter two or something like that, right? Which is fine as long as your neighbor doesn't know you're in the DMV at the same time. So I don't know if that really answers your questions, but a lot of us on the commission feel like our hand has been forced by this, and we're trying to minimize the work that the greater legislature has to deal with by distilling these issues down, getting stakeholders on the same page ahead of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesh. You know, I oftentimes have lamented the fact that with regard to cybersecurity that and cyber threats, or all, as we coordinate with Homeland Security and whatnot, and I see your commission as maybe having a broader breadth or scope in some cases that would almost be availed to review coming threats and use those in a confidential or secure setting and contemplate what to do with them, as opposed to your point, rather than reacting to them, being out in front of measures that would protect data that is from the citizens, but also be aware of protecting them before an intrusion happens. So I can see great value in this initiative. I support your work.
Thank you. And if I can speak to that, Mr. Chair, as well, just to clarify, I have another bill that's up that I'm working with Representative Johnson on. He reminded me that I had dropped it in previous years and asked me to drop it this year again, and it's the Legislative Commission on Intelligence. And I've been asked, it goes to a little bit of what you were talking about. I've been asked by Representative Scott if I would just fold this idea into the Data Practice Commission. My previous reluctance had been that I didn't think that's what Mary Liz Hulberg had intended this commission to be, but I think it's a valid point. And the purpose of the commission is this. In the years after the Pentagon Papers, when Congress realized that the executive branch was doing all kinds of stuff that they did not necessarily approve, and we ran into problems associated with that, the House and Senate gave themselves select committees on intelligence and said that military and other types of clandestine agencies had to report to them so that they had direct oversight over what was happening. This related to the technologies that were coming online by law enforcement in Minnesota that we didn't find out about until much later. And by that time, the Pandora's box had been opened and people's data was public because they hadn't seen fit to come up and ask for a data set to be created for the collection of that data. And that this would be a commission that would not necessarily meet openly because otherwise the cops wouldn't come in and tell us what we're doing because the bad guys would know what we're doing. And so it was supposed to be a hybrid. Now, that isn't part of what this commission does, because this commission does not have the authority to do of like what the Capital Security Commission does, which is to meet in secret to talk about that air vent that we don't want the terrorists to be able to climb through in the Capitol and know about it or something. It is something that I've put forward because I think there's an inevitability that we will continue to have to chase after the problems that have already been created if we don't have that, but it's on the table as to its own kind of committee or commission or joint committee versus being merged with this. I think Representative Scott brought it up that it could be a part of this, and that would be valid. So that topic is still on the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Elkins.
I have another bill, so if we can
just
moving along here. I think that there are a couple of things that I know I can reasonably foresee over the next, even 5 to 10 years, that where the state could become involved in facilitating the exchange of healthcare records or data being shared among connected and automated vehicles, where I think we're going to want to get ahead of the curve on those things, anticipate what some of those things might be, and be prepared through the Data Practices Commission to have both data practices rules and more broadly just standards for the exchange of that kind of information. So those are just examples of things that I think where this body would be, we would want them to weigh in.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Representative Lesh, I'll renew my motion that House File 804 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And next we have Representative Fisher, House File 2084. And I'll move that House File 2084 to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2084 today. This is about extending the sunset on the Legislative Water Commission. The Legislative Water Commission has been around for 5 years now. The primary work that the Legislative Water Commission has been focusing on is addressing long-term water issues facing the state of Minnesota. When the Legislative Water Commission was first reformed 5 years ago, we were in a very reactive state trying to address water issues in the state of Minnesota. And the problem is that when you're dealing with water issues, it's very difficult to get the whole breadth of the situation in a current committee hearing like we have during the legislative session. And many of the issues we deal with, we need a lot of long-term work on. We do a lot of work with the different stakeholders that are out there. A lot of times it's just being able to bring people to the table, facilitate discussions to try to find the best solutions, because water issues are very different across the state of Minnesota. The one way you might address it in the southeast corner of the state may actually make it worse for people up in the northwest part of the state. So it's very careful work in trying to balance it. One of the recommendations of the Legislative Water Commission was that we continue to move the Legislative Water Commission sunset out for another 6 years. We feel that there's still a lot of work to be done to stay proactive on water. This has been a bipartisan work that we've had going forward, and I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Kamal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What have been the achievements of the Legislative Water Commission?
Mr. Fisher. First of all, some of the achievements that we've had is over the last couple of years, we've done some revision of statutes on stormwater, holding back and permitting issues there, streamlining the role of what the state does to be more efficient. We found a lot of areas where there are contradictions. This year we had a list of 13 recommendations that were made to the to be incorporated by the legislature. Out of those 13, over two-thirds of those are currently moving through the process. A lot of them are dealing with instances of holding water back on the land, making sure that we're improving water quality, making sure that we've got the toolbox expanded so that instead of mandating tools across the state, is making sure that we're creating a toolbox so that people can use the appropriate tools for each of the areas, because geology and hydrology are so different across the state of Minnesota.
Representative Quah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what out of, you know, I noticed the House research has seven different entities listed, and they say, and other water-related reports, et cetera. What has the Legislative Water Commission done to try and fix the overlapping, you know, there's, I don't know, there are too many different areas of our lives for our citizens to where you've got so many entities that if you're going to do something, you're not sure who to talk to. And I've heard back from constituents that they get two or three different opinions and are told contradictory information. So how has the Legislative Water Commission moved to fix that patchwork?
One of the things that we've been working on, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. One of the things that we've done was there's a bill that's moving forward right now, House File 875, that gets to a heart of a lot of these issues around water planning. Because of the way that the federal government had set up water regulations and the way the state had to address water planning, say if you wanted to protect impaired waters, you had to go through a separate planning process than if you're protecting drinking water. Also, those same processes did not allow you to address water planning and protection of waters that were still pristine or waters that were already becoming impaired. So instead of going through, so what this the 875 bill is doing, instead of going through seven different planning processes, incorporating the same people at different points in time, it allows everybody to be brought together in one entire process to do all the planning together instead of having to do seven different events to address planning. And that's making sure we're incorporating people from the locals all the way up to the state levels to make sure that we're not missing anyone in the process. That's been a very involved, elaborated process as it's very technical, and we've been moving that process forward. That does not address all the issues out there. There are some issues that we're talking about right now that are even larger. Do we start taking a look at how do we do water governance here differently in the state? Some people are proposing maybe we bring it all together and have one grand water structure as they do in the state of Wisconsin and other states. Some are saying maybe we just need an ombudsperson. These are some of the longer range, bigger things that we still need to take a look at that we'll be looking at going forward.
Representative, any further questions? Well, Representative Vogel.
Thank you. Quickly, just curious, how often does it meet and how is it funded?
Mr. Fisher, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel. First of all, we do meet monthly. Typically what happens is in the month of May we don't meet because we're usually coming up on the end of session and we don't have time. And it is funded through the legislative, and I'm forgetting the words. I'll refer to staff so they can make sure to get the wording right for me.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair and members, the Water Commission is funded through the base funding for the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And I should note there's a little bit something unusual here. The fiscal note hasn't been completed yet, but when the commission was originally funded in 2014, the language said that funding of $145,000 was included in the base through fiscal year 19, when the sunset would go into place. But through a variety of oversights of everyone involved, the base was not adjusted downward for the LCC, so the funding is included in the forecast base for the LCC. So continuing If the sunset is removed, they already have the funding.
Any further questions?
Lippert, Representative Lippert.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. As a new member of the Legislative Water Commission, I can affirm the complexity of the issues that come before this group, and also believe that more conversation, more in-depth conversation is needed, and that this commission steps into that role. And water issues will become increasingly important and intense as we move forward. Everything points towards that, so I think this makes sense for us. Thank you.
Now, any further questions? Seeing none, anybody in the audience that needs to speak on this bill? Seeing no one rushing to the podium, I'll renew my motion that House File 2084 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your consideration.
And thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
And with that, members, nothing else is on our agenda. We are adjourned.